HYY.
This is Radio Time. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. Max Brooks first heard about the Harlem Hellfighters when he was just 11 years old. He was intrigued by the true story of a regiment of black American soldiers who defeated the Germans on the battlefield during World War I while confronting racism and discrimination in the U.S. military and on the home front. Brooks originally tried to sell his screenplay of their exploits and heroism to Hollywood, but there was no interest. So instead, he wrote about them in a graphic novel titled The Harlem Hellfighters, illustrated by Kanan White, that has just been published. And now, movie makers are interested in turning this largely forgotten story into a film. Max Brooks is our guest today on Radio Times. He joins us to talk about writing and researching this novel. A great pleasure. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times, and congratulations on your graphic novel.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
It's so interesting. This was a story that you first heard about 30 years ago, and it has stayed with you all those years. How come?
You know, I think initially it was the injustice of it. You know, when you're a white kid growing up on the west side of L.A., injustice is not part of your diet. So I think that was initially shocking. And as I got older and I started to research about it, their combat record, I think, is what stuck with me. I had seen the movie Glory, and I was very fascinated by the 54th Massachusetts. But had the 54th been a white unit, there wouldn't be much to write home about. As opposed to the 369th, which, had they been a white unit, we'd already be on our third remake of their movie. I would say that Henry Johnson, James Cagney would have played him a long time ago.
But what we're talking about is, and there's a whole story here, but at least on the battlefield, and they fought with the French, interestingly, because the Americans really weren't interested in having black soldiers fighting side by side with white soldiers.
Yes.
In World War I. But their extraordinary heroism on the battlefield, and the fact that they fought something like 119 days straight.
191, yes.
191 straight.
What happened was, the United States government, this was the time of the Great Migration. This was the time when lots of black people were moving into northern cities, and it was really scaring the pants off the white establishment. And the last thing they wanted, the U.S. government, was for black people to come home as heroes, showing their communities what they are capable of. So they did everything possible to sabotage this unit. Poor uniforms, poor training. They wouldn't give them rifles because they were giving away rifles to private clubs, private shooting clubs. So the Harlem Hellfighters actually had to pretend to be a private shooting club to get their own guns. Finally, in the last act of humiliation, they gave them to the French. And that's a very big deal, because during World War I, General John Pershing, the commander-in-chief of the U.S. forces, said, "I will not allow American troops to be fed piecemeal into the British and French armies. They will fight as an American army, American flag, under an American commander, ... except for the black guys. Give them to the French."
And that's based on research that you did?
Yes, that's based on real research. The French used to call them the little black orphans when they first got them. And the French had actually had a lot of good luck with their black African troops. The black colonial troops, the Senegalese, Moroccans, had done stellar duty in combat. So maybe in the French reverse racism, they thought, well, maybe all black people can fight this well.
Well, the French called them men of bronze. It was the Germans who called them the Harlem Hellfighters.
Yes, yes. The French later dubbed them the men of bronze out of respect, but the Germans called them the Harlem Hellfighters out of fear.
They, and this goes back even before, I guess, while the war was going on. So this group of I guess they were members of the National Guard in New York.
Yes.
They're sent down to South Carolina to essentially train for the war effort. This is, you know, the Deep South. This is South Carolina. This is a time of intense racial tension.
And this was 2 weeks after a horrific race riot in Houston, where black soldiers had rioted and shot up the town and had been disgraced. So literally, the mayor of Spartanburg, South Carolina, wrote in the New York Times, "Hey, do not send these guys down here." And he used the word trouble. I mean, he was warning. He said, if you send them down here, especially after Houston, you're asking for trouble. So why would the U.S. Army do that? Why would the U.S. Army put more black troops in such a frying pan at this particular time?
And why do you think that is?
I think they set them up to fail. I think the U.S. government was hoping against hope that these troops would be disgraced and would finish the war in the U.S. digging ditches.
And I guess once they're sent over to Europe, their original job was to unload ships. I mean, that was what they were there to do, essentially, as a kind of support force for the U.S. military?
They were stevedores. They were initially meant to improve the infrastructure for when the white troops would come over. They were just manual labor, and it was only because of lobbying by their commanding officer and because the French were, frankly, so desperate for anybody who could hold a rifle that these men were put in combat.
This is it's a novel. I mean, it's based, obviously, in many ways on a lot of research that you have done, and there's more and more research, I guess, on the Harlem Hellfighters. Why did you want to do a novel, though?
You know, I had originally written it as a screenplay. Back in the 90s, when TNT had done Buffalo Soldiers, and when, originally I thought it was TNT, had did Tuskegee Airmen.
Oh.
Spike Lee corrected me, said
okay.
It was HBO. So these two black military movies had come out, TV movies had come out, and I thought the time is right for Harlem Hellfighters. So I started doing real research, and I wrote it as a script. I brought it to TNT. Nope. Nobody else wanted to do it. And finally, I turned my back on Hollywood and I got into comic books and I said, you know what? This would be a great comic book.
And the person that you got to illustrate it is a pretty well-known comic book illustrator, or I guess illustrator,
yes,
named Kanan White. And there's several things, and obviously we're on the radio, so I can't do real justice to it. One is that it's in black and white, which I thought was really appropriate. I mean, if we're going to think of this in visual terms or maybe even movie terms, back, you know, 100 years ago, things were in black and white.
And yeah, what's great about Kanan, one of the reasons I wanted to work with him was his attention to detail. He's very, very specific and very intricate in his work. And I think the problem is with a lot of comic books is when you colorize them, you lose a little bit. You lose a level of detail. And I'm glad that we didn't do that. I'm glad that we keep those little tiny things that make it so intricate. So, you know, Kanan, he's the rock star of the project, easily.
And you can also see when their faces, you know, when in the square there's somebody's face, the real sort of pathos and character that comes through on the face. And then you see these scenes of unbelievable, you know, mayhem and fighting and violence and just gore.
And, you know, that was a very specific choice I made, is I'd never wanted to be accused of gratuitous violence. So I made sure that every act of carnage in this book was based on actual research. Everything I had ever read, I had to ground in this book. So nothing was put in there for shock value.
And World War I was just a horrifically violent war. I mean, you have the sort of collision of war fighting. You had trench warfare, people sitting in trenches and shooting at each other.
Yeah, you know, the real tragedy of World War I is you had all this new technology, barbed wire, machine guns, poison gas. But the problem is the generals had come of age during the Napoleonic era. So they were still stuck in the mindset of bravery, charges, cavalry, and they couldn't make that mental shift to the fact that the entire face of war had changed.
Some of your characters are real people, and some of them are, I guess, an amalgam or maybe even fictional characters.
And that was a conscious choice because I wanted to be very respectful of the families of the Hellfighters, because this is not my story. This is their story, and I'm just telling it. So by making some characters fictional or fictionalized, I was able to take more artistic liberties and have, say, a character like Wayne Edge,
right,
say that he joined the army because white people are paying him to kill other white people. Now, I couldn't do that with someone like Henry Johnson because he's a real guy, and I don't want his great-great-great-grandchildren saying, hey, he never said that.
You had a professor named Wayne Edge. Do I
did.
Have that right?
Yes.
So this was a bit of a shout-out to him?
That's a shout-out to Professor Edge. I did my semester abroad in college at the University of the Virgin Islands in St. Thomas.
Oh.
And Professor Edge was a mainlander, and boy, he was a firebrand. He was passionate about the crimes of the white man. And he said the biggest crime was erasing black history and black accomplishments. And that really stuck with me. Because I think, you know, being Jewish, half our holidays are spent reminding us how far we've come and what we've done, which gives us strength for the future. And I thought, wow, what if that history had just been erased? Where would we be?
And does Wayne Edge, is he still alive? Does he know he's featured in
this? I have
his...
no idea. The last time
heard
of Professor Edge, he had moved with his wife to Botswana back in the 90s.
Oh, wow.
So I hope he hears about this, and I hope he's pleased.
One of the characters' last name is Europe. He's though based on a true character,
real guy, James Reese Europe. He was
interesting last name.
Yes, yeah, one of the founders of Ragtime, and he brought Ragtime or jazz over to France, And had he not been murdered right after the war, I think he would be as famous as Duke Ellington right now.
Wow. When you were writing this book, I mean, were you thinking in pictures? I mean, when you have a graphic novel, obviously the words and the images are so strong, and they have to work in tandem. But sometimes the images can overpower the words too.
I think so, and I think with a comic book, it is the duty of the writer to know when to step back and let the pictures speak for themselves. And as a novelist, that was a challenge for me, because you always want your words to be the star. But the truth is, a comic book is a visual medium, and the words are not the star.
Yeah,
you know, the words are Abbott, the pictures are Costello, and you have to be okay with that.
And do you think in terms of a storyboard?
I think so. I think when you do a comic book, you have to think that way. And you have to let scenes breathe. You have to know when to compress the story, when to expand it. And so that's a challenge for someone like me.
There's a scene, and as we know from the soldiers, the Marines that fought in this war, just the terrible psychological price that they paid. And you have a scene in here where I guess they have some kind of PTSD. It's a hospital.
Yeah.
And there's a reference to zombies.
Yes, I call them zombies the living dead, because back then it was the first time that there had been enough battle trauma that they actually gave it a term, shell shock, and they actually started to treat it as a genuine affliction. And so I have a scene where there's a hospital of just young men with their bodies intact, but their minds just destroyed. And that was a casualty of this war.
And did you, I mean, the zombies works for you? I don't know, zombies is sort of how you have made a name for yourself.
Yeah, no, I decided to just throw it in there, but it's true. To me, they really are the living dead, because their bodies look human, but their minds are not anymore.
Are there still living members of the Hellfighters, Harlem Hellfighters, that you were able to talk to?
Oh, no. The last ones died, I think, probably 1970s, 1980s. Mm-hmm. But I was very lucky to find a documentary called Men of Bronze, made in the 70s with, they might be the last two living Hellfighters, I don't know, but they interviewed two of the Hellfighters, and one of them, Melville T. Miller, I call him my primary dialogue coach.
Oh, wow.
Because I watched him every day and studied him.
And his sort of his dialogue or his way of speaking,
yes,
is in here.
He is how the character of Mark speaks, and that was very important to me. He sort of talks like this. He talked like my grandfather. He says, "Yeah, we're a bunch of kids, 18, 19 years old. We're at a war." he was a great, great man to listen to.
I'm assuming they're probably grandchildren or maybe great-grandchildren of the Hellfighters?
Oh,
or who?
Probably great-great. I mean, you got to think now. I'm a Gen Xer. I'm 41, almost 42.
Right.
And so that would be the most Gen Xers, their grandparents are in World War II. Most millennials, their great-grandparents are World War II, so that would probably be their great-great-grandparents.
Yeah. And your dad, Mel Brooks, he served in World War II.
Combat engineer. He was in Europe.
Did he talk about that?
Oh, yeah. I think it's what got me into war initially as a kid was, you know, I grew up hearing stories about rubbing bacon fat on his feet so he wouldn't get frostbite and Germans booby-trapping toilets.
That's Max Brooks, our guest today on Radio Times. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. Open up the lines as well at 1-888-477-9499. We're talking about his graphic novel, a new graphic novel. It's called The Harlem Hellfighters. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Montgomery School supports WHYY, an independent school for pre-K through grade 8. Montgomery School believes when children find joy in learning, they are inspired to explore their world and succeed in their educational pursuits. Montgomery will host a pre-K visit day on April 5th at 10 a.m. and an open house on April 10th at 7 p.m. on their campus in Chester Springs. Details at montgomeryschool.org/admissions. Montgomery School. Inspired to explore. Prepared to succeed.
Steve, let me ask you something. When you're hosting NPR's Morning Edition, how do you keep all those news stories straight in your head?
By listening. I don't pretend to know all the answers. My job is to know who to ask and how to ask them. At NPR's Morning Program, our job is to push for real stories, honest answers.
And you can listen with us on Morning Edition from NPR News.
Weekday mornings on WHYY. Support for WHYY comes from Beck Institute, internationally recognized source for cognitive behavior therapy, welcoming clients to their Center for Psychotherapy in Bella Cynwyd. Established by Dr. Judith Beck and Dr. Aaron Beck, founder of cognitive behavior therapy, Beck Institute provides effective treatment for challenges including depression, anxiety, stress, and relationship problems. Details at beckinstitute.org or 610-664-3020.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Max Brooks. He made a name for himself as a zombie expert with three books, World War Z, The Zombie Survival Guide, and The Zombie Survival Guide Recorded Attacks. His new book is based on a story he first heard when he was a young boy about a highly decorated regiment of Black American soldiers. They beat back the Germans in World War I, hailed in France for their heroism on the battlefield, and largely forgotten in this country. And we are talking about the Harlem Hellfighters, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. I'm curious, with this regiment, how many were wounded? How many were killed? Do you know?
I know the casualties were extraordinarily high in this unit, and it got higher as the war went on, when they actually started to go on the advance against the Germans. I mean, it was a brutal war of machine guns and landmines, poison gas. These were all things that they had to sort of learn when they got there. I mean, many American units suffer very high casualties.
But they had to learn, because when they were at basic training, I guess, in South Carolina, they had brooms, you know, to use as a weapon.
Yeah, they were not taught how to deal with trench warfare. And the problem was, that was actually endemic of all armies, it was hard to teach about this new brand of warfare. It was such a shock when they got there. They were shocked that the trenches did not move. They expected a war of mobility. So the notion that you'd be sitting in this mud hole for 4 years, and the Germans sitting right over there, and in between just dead bodies, a horrible, horrible war.
Do you know why they fought so hard? I mean, here they were fighting for America, a country that had discriminated against them in such obvious and overt ways.
I think that they were fighting for the very reason that their government was trying to suppress them, is they were fighting as proof of what they were capable of and what their community was capable of. I think that they wanted to show how much they deserved a place at the American table.
And they fought largely in France, yes? With the French.
Yes, in France, with the French. The French integrated with them and treated them as equals. And however, they started to do so well in combat that the United States Army actually sent out a memorandum to the French, essentially saying, do not spoil them. And giving them specifics. Don't shake hands with them. Don't visit with them socially. Don't praise them in the presence of white soldiers. I mean, basically all this Jim Crow, saying, hey, don't let them get a big head, because we don't want them coming home thinking they're more than they are.
I want you to read a quote in this book, and this was a journalist, I guess, who was covering the war, a guy named Irvin S. Cobb.
Yes, Irvin S. Cobb was, we would probably call him a horrific racist, but back then he was just called a guy. And he wrote about the Battle of Henry Johnson. Henry Johnson was in the trenches by himself with Private Needham Roberts. They were jumped by a whole platoon of Germans. And Roberts was wounded, and Johnson fought them all off, eventually fighting them off with a knife when his gun ran out of bullets. So Irvin S. Cobb, this former bigot, wrote, "If ever proof was needed, which it is not, that the color of a man's skin has nothing to do with the color of his soul, this twain then and there offered it in abundance. They were soldiers who wore their uniforms with a smartened pride, who expressed a sincere, heartfelt inclination to get a whack at their foe. As a result of what our black soldiers are going to do in this war, a word that has been uttered billions of times, sometimes in derision, sometimes in hate, but which I am sure never fell on black ears, but it left behind a sting for the heart, is going to have new meaning for us all. And that hereafter, N-I-G-G-E-R, will merely be another way of spelling the word American."
That's so powerful and also so disturbing at the same time.
Well, you know, that was the language of the day.
It's 100 years old.
Yeah, and I think we have to be very careful, and I had to be very careful as a writer, not to write for the time. you have to be true to history, and you can't edit it because of political correctness now. This is how people thought. This is how people wrote. And I think it was very profound that this Southern racist had this change of heart. I mean, this guy could have been killed for writing stuff like that.
He called him American.
He called him an American. I mean, wow, that's amazing.
There's also a scene here, and we see one of the black soldiers in bed with a white French woman.
Yes.
And I guess, you know, fraternizing with the, not the enemy, obviously, but with allies. But just
That's terrifying. And, you know, in some ways in this country, there still is that double standard. I think Ted Nugent recently called the president of the United States a subhuman mongrel. And I think the word mongrel is very important because as much as racists hate black people, they really hate the product of a black man and a white woman. They hate that union. The notion that a black man could take a white woman to bed is terrifying. And you can see in this book, that was a big fear that, my God, these guys would have white French girlfriends. Mm-hmm. What if they come home and get white American girlfriends?
While this war is going on, and this is also included in your graphic novel, and this is true, President Wilson showed D.W. Griffith's Birth of a Nation that was showed at the White House.
Yes.
I think if anyone has seen that film, it's just shockingly racist.
Yeah, I have a shout out to Birth of a Nation where our main character, Mark, he's fighting specifically because he was an usher in a movie theater and watched Birth of a Nation. For people who don't know it, it's essentially a stirring, rousing, heroic epic about the birth of the KKK.
Exactly.
And it was widely received. I think Wilson screened it at the White House. And this book is about imagery, and that's very important. That's why I kept it as a comic book. Imagery is so important.
Is it because imagery is so visceral?
Because, yes, imagery has the power to change minds. So a film like Birth of a Nation has the power to generate so much hatred and so much fear. And specifically with the Hellfighters, their worst insult was being denied a parade. All the National Guard units in New York were put together in what was called the Rainbow Division, and they were allowed to march off to freedom, march off to war in New York City. Big gala, ticker tape, hooray, good luck, boys. The Hellfighters were not allowed to march with them because they were told, I'm not kidding, black is not a color of the rainbow. Mm. So that denial of imagery was so important. And when they came home, they got their parade. They came home, marched in triumph down Fifth Avenue. A million New Yorkers of all color turned out to cheer them home. And that was their true victory.
And that was their parade by themselves, yes?
I'm pretty sure that they might have marched home with all the other American soldiers, but they came home to the cheers of everyone. They were not denied that parade.
And yet this is a story that's sort of been lost to history.
I think most of World War I has been lost to history. It's not a very clean war. I think World War II is bigger and more dramatic and more visual. It's like Lord of the Rings with tanks. You know, whereas World War I is young boys freezing and dying in trenches and mud. And for what? And for 4 years.
It's interesting, as you said, you had this idea that Hollywood or TV or someone might be interested in turning this story into a movie or a TV show, and now there's a lot of interest. Do you think it's maybe 12 Years a Slave and 42? I'm thinking of all the movies that have come out recently that are dealing with some of these racial issues.
I think we're at a perfect storm right now because I think it's not – I think all these movies are successful, 42, The Butler, 12 Years a Slave. I think they're all successful because we are living in a time of sort of the last civil rights battle with gay equality. And also, I think there's a lot of backlash against President Obama. I think it brings a lot of racism bubbling to the surface. The Trayvon Martin case, you know, the fact that George Zimmerman is now signing autographs at gun shows, I think brings all this back to the surface. And I think even though we've made tremendous strides in this country, we still have a ways to go.
Mm. And I mean, it sounds like Will Smith and some others are interested in this story.
Yeah, ironically, I spent 15 years having this rejected. The whole point of writing it as a comic book was so I wouldn't have to depend on Hollywood. And then 2 weeks before the book comes out, I get a call from Will Smith's company. He wants to produce it with Sony, and they want me to write the first draft of the script.
Oh, wow.
So ain't that ironic.
Ain't that ironic. And I'm curious, you've written script. Did you write the script for World War Z?
No. I mean, I always say I had more to do with getting President Obama elected than making World War Z. At least I phone banked for Obama.
But nothing to do with World
nothing.
War Z.
I literally just showed up at the premiere.
Oh, is that right?
I got my popcorn and watched a movie with the same title as my book.
I, I do want to get to that, but I am curious about what you think it'll take to turn a graphic novel into a screenplay. Or do you think it'll take, I mean, maybe it's already storyboarded out?
No, I think this is actually much easier than something like World War Z, which is an oral history. How do you do a bunch of interviews and make it into a movie? Mm-hmm. Whereas this is a very clear-cut story. You have your characters, you have your through line, you even have your images. It is storyboarded. So I think the transition from page to screen is infinitely easier.
Are there certain actors you have in mind?
I do, of course. I'm not saying nothing. The trick to surviving in Hollywood with your sanity intact is managing expectations.
Oh, okay.
But, are you kidding?
We're in Philadelphia here, so you know. It's
a foreign country over there. I will say that in a perfect world, I would love to have an ensemble cast because that's the great thing about war movies. You know, The Longest Day or A Bridge Too Far. I love those movies where you say, hey, you know, I know that guy and that guy. Oh, my God, there's Ryan O'Neill. There's Robert Redford. There's Denham Elliott. So I would love to have an ensemble piece where even if somebody comes in for a line or a walk-on scene, wouldn't that be wonderful?
And that's Max Brooks, our guest today on Radio Times. We're talking about his new book. It's a graphic novel called The Harlem Hellfighters. And he also has written a number of books about zombies. And again, we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. And you can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Coane. We did a show a couple of years ago. There's a professor at Tufts University who wrote a book about zombies and foreign policy.
Dan Dresner.
We had him on the show. Is he a friend of yours?
He's a friend of mine.
We had so much fun because we pulled, you know, clips from various zombie movies and sort of infiltrated them into his view of foreign policy.
You know, he's great because he's an example of the good part about zombies being so popular is you start to be able to teach really important things. It's like the CDC having a zombie plan. How great is that? They don't believe in zombies, but they're getting young people interested in preparing for natural disasters, and they're doing it through zombies. That's wonderful.
What do zombies mean to you, though? Or what did they mean to you?
You know, I was just always afraid of them, terrified. But to me, it's always the big picture of the zombies because I realized when I wrote Zombie Survival Guide, most people would die in a zombie outbreak without ever having seen a zombie. They would die of starvation, dehydration, malnutrition, accidents. It's like any natural disaster. It's the secondary and tertiary problems of that disaster that are the real killers. And that's why I wrote Zombie Survival Guide and World War Z. Mm-hmm. And that's why I've been asked to lecture at places like the U.S. Naval War College. Because it's those big picture, those threads of society being frayed that we really need to be careful with.
But would you say you were or are a fearful person? I mean, the fears... I mean, I think we all have fears.
Oh, I think that's a grand understatement.
A grand understatement.
Yes. No, I'm a very neurotic.
Are you?
Please. I used to have panic attacks watching Fraggle Rock. Because the theme song is Throw Your Cares Away, Worry for Another Day.
Yes.
And those lyrics used to remind me how many worries I used to have. So it used to jumpstart all my worries as Fraggle Rock came on. That's how nervous and neurotic I am.
I mean, obviously it takes a lot of mental energy to try to control those thoughts and images,
yeah.
I guess.
Yeah, just sort of always living with it and always sort of trying to keep my anxieties at bay and be disciplined and move forward. It takes a lot of energy.
Yeah. Why do you think... you were or are so nervous, so anxious?
I don't know. I mean, I think I had neurotic parents to start with, but then I think I had certain things happen when I was a kid that sort of made it worse. When I was 12 and 13, a friend of mine was hit by a car and killed.
Oh, goodness.
So I think that sort of made me aware of my mortality, and I never had that sort of youthful invincibility because I was always aware of how much I could die.
Yeah.
The dyslexia kind of knocked away my self-esteem. I had physical problems. I had a cyst in my fibula, in my bone when I was a kid. I broke my leg twice. So sort of always aware of frailties. It was always there.
And I should say, your parents are in Bancroft and Mel Brooks. You said they were, I mean, a lot of parents are neurotic. You're probably looking at one right now, but they were neurotic. They had worries. And you were an only child as well.
I was an only child. And I think there was that lot of fear. Remember, also, I had World War II parents who were very frightened of this modern world. You know, baby boomer parents, they understood things like sex, drugs, crime. My parents didn't. And this was a time when kids were being kidnapped and killed. You know, that was the birth of that. The McMartin preschool molestations happened when I was a kid. And also just growing up in L.A., you know, crack and gangs, and then we had earthquakes and we had fires and we had floods, and it was the end of the Cold War, so we still had nuclear war drills. So it really was this sort of great conjunction of neurosis.
But do you think writing about zombies is sort of is your way of dealing with some of these fears, putting them in their place, putting them in a book?
Oh, yeah. No, definitely. I mean, it's my way of sort of exercising all the things I used to be afraid of. The truth is Zombie Survival Guide is my earthquake preparedness kit. It's everything I planned for in an earthquake. You know, that's why when I write about zombies, it's not macho alpha male with a big gun blowing them away. It's things like purifying water and finding a source of penicillin. Because those are the things I think about.
Right. And that's obviously what the military thinks about because you're very popular on military bases.
Right, right. I mean, because when I talk to the military, we talk about, you know, wars throughout history. How many soldiers have died from combat deaths as opposed to how many soldiers died just from bad hygiene, disease, VD, things like all those things you have to think of that are so important. So I'm always sort of peeling the layers back.
Did you like World War Z, the movie? I know there were problems getting it made. I personally enjoyed it.
You know, strangely enough, because it was so different from my book, it was easier to watch. And that's a big deal. You know, had it been my characters being manipulated and my story being eviscerated, it would have been much, much harder to watch. But once you got past the opening title, which, by the way, what a title.
Yeah.
I was just watching someone else's movie. I was watching 28 Days Later on steroids. And so it was easier for me to divorce myself from the movie.
You mentioned the fact that you were dyslexic. Was that something that you figured out or your parents or teachers figured out?
My mother. God bless my mother.
Your mother did.
I mean, we're talking about a saint who gave up her glamorous Hollywood career to raise a special needs child. So she had me tested at the Marian Frostic Center when I was a kid, discovered I was dyslexic, and she created a special education system just for me.
Wow.
Things like meeting with my teachers every year, making sure my tests were untimed, making sure I got tutored. She took all my school reading list, all my books, to the Braille Institute and had them transcribed onto audiobooks so I could listen to my reading list. Otherwise, I wouldn't have made it. Wow. It's that simple. So all these tricks for getting me past the system, it's all my mom. I mean, had I had any mother but her, we wouldn't be talking right now. I'd probably be in rehab somewhere.
And was this something that she just figured out on her own because she knew her son and she obviously did some research to figure out how to help you read? Or
my mother had a very analytical mind. It's something Hollywood didn't much care for. But she was a closet scientist. Her favorite book was The Microbe Hunters. So she was always a problem solver. And I was a problem. And so she made me her main project. And she got up every day and thought, how am I going to make my kid's life easier and lessen the damage on his self-esteem?
And she obviously did that.
And she did that. It's all because of her.
And I have to say, open to the very end of World War Z, and in the very last page just says, I love you, Mom.
Yeah, that book, all my success is because I had a mom who cared and who put in the time.
And, I mean, but you're a writer now.
Yeah, I'm a dyslexic kid who's a writer. It's kind of like the sickly kid becoming a professional athlete. And that's because of my mom. One of the things she did was she said, look, you want to be a writer. I've seen it. You love writing. Well, I'm going to make you take a typing course. I was in eighth grade. I said, oh, my God, Mom, I don't want to take a typing course.
Of course.
Yeah, I said, why can't I just have a secretary like Dad and just dictate? And my mom said, absolutely not. Computers are the way of the future. She knew. She said, nobody's going to practice handwriting in the future. Nobody's going to handwrite books anymore. You need to learn how to type. So that was instrumental.
And she was right.
And she was right. I mean, it was unbelievable how she knew.
Well, that's our guest, Max Brooks, talking about his mother, Anne Bancroft, and his father, Mel Brooks. And we're also talking about his new graphic novel called The Harlem Hellfighters. Much more after this very short break. We've got some callers that want to join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. That's me. I'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Rutgers University. Master's degrees available on a flexible schedule through online study. Now open for applications. More information at radioonline.rutgers.edu. On the next Fresh Air, the NSA operation that infiltrated the servers of a Chinese telecom giant. We talk with David Sanger of the New York Times about the escalating cyber Cold War between the U.S. and China. Much of his reporting on that story comes from documents leaked by Edward Snowden. Join us. This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
As Russian troops remain near the eastern border of Ukraine, Russia's neighbors say the ghosts of Soviet days are still alive and well.
Once you have a madman in the head, it's uncontrolled power, which is the worst what can happen to any country in the world.
We'll hear views from the former Soviet bloc all this week on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY, the Lincoln Motor Company, featuring a panoramic retractable roof on the 2014 Lincoln MKZ that opens up to over 15 square feet of skylight. More at Lincoln.com.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne, talking with Max Brooks about a whole bunch of stuff, including zombies, his new book, his new graphic novel called The Harlem Hellfighters, and we've been talking a bit about his parents, Ann Bancroft and Mel Brooks. We're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. And let me give out that tweet again. It's my name, at Marty Moscow-Wayne. Let me get David from Mayfair to join us on Radio Times. David, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi there.
Could you talk more about James Reese Europe? He recorded How You're Going to Keep Them Down on the Farm, which is a significant song in World War One, and also in the 80s, Carnegie Hall reproduced old concerts, and they reproduced a 1912 concert that he was involved in.
Oh,
I mean,
good.
He is very significant.
Yes, he is, David.
Oh, yeah.
Go ahead, Max.
Jim Europe had an amazing songs. How Are You Going to Keep Him Down on the Farm? I actually listened to it. I bought a CD of his collected works with Noble Sissel, with the great drum major. And How Are You Going to Keep Him Down on the Farm was a famous song. He didn't write that. But his rendition of it was amazing. And my favorite song of his was about leading a patrol in no man's land.
Oh, wow.
And his lyrics about hand grenades, Minenwerfers, gas, it's an amazing song. And it really encapsulates trench warfare in that sort of happy ragtime beat. Jim Europe was a very driven man. And he was the toast of Broadway, the toast of New York. To give up his mega celebrity, this is a black man in 1917, to give up all that to go fight in the trenches of World War One, because he was also head of a machine gun company, is I think unheard of in today's America. I always say that would be like Kanye going to Afghanistan. You know, that kind of sacrifice and that kind of courage, I think, is phenomenal.
And just another little piece of history, when they came back from Europe, from World War One, this was called the Red Summer of 1919.
Yes.
So this, again, was a time of intense racial strife in this country.
Yeah, huge, huge backlash, because literally they came home as heroes, and that created a backlash of terror among the white establishment that, oh my God, they think they're Americans now. They think they're first-class citizens. We need to put a stop to that. So there was a tremendous racial violence that summer.
Mm. Let me get, looks like Tara from Doylestown to join our conversation. Excuse me, Tara, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty. Max, I want to thank you so much for bringing the story of World War One's very unique story to the limelight. We travel with our young boys, ages 6 and 11, to all kinds of historical sites, and we brought them to Verdun, two years ago. And we were saddened to see there's no one visiting the museum there. There's no one visiting the trenches or these destroyed villages there. And we were just absolutely blown away seeing the ossuary, just thousands and thousands of bones. It's just a profoundly chilling experience to think about World War One and try to impart that, any aspect of it, to the kids. So thank you so much, and absolutely fabulous book.
Thank you.
Thanks. Yeah, go ahead.
And you know, that's a really good point, because most Americans don't know anything about World War One. So the challenge of this book was not just telling the stories of the Hellfighters. I also had to tell the background story of World War One. I had to just give people the basics, the fact that this was a war of attrition, of guys getting out of trenches and being mowed down by machine guns again and again and again. I mentioned Verdun. I mentioned the Somme. You have to give the context of the Hellfighters, and that it was such a horrific war, and I think that can't be lost.
And we're coming up on the anniversary of the start of World War One as well, so hopefully there'll be more attention paid to what happened in the beginning of the 20th century.
I hope so, because it really was an accidental war, and it really did bring all of Europe. I mean, Europe spent 500 years building itself up, and it all came crashing down in this war, and I think that can't be forgotten.
Have you gone to Verdun and places that Tara described?
I want to go to Verdun. I also want to go to Sachsen, which was a battle the Hellfighters fought in. Mm. I would love to get over there and see that. I have seen the trenches and trench warfare. I think if you go to London, go to the Imperial War Museum. They have an amazing exhibit about trench life. Because just forget the battles. Life in the trenches of the rats and the lice, the mud, the filth, I think is very educational.
Tara, thanks for the call to Radio Times. It's interesting that, did you ever think of joining the military or being in the military?
My limited military experience was ROTC during a Desert Shield, Desert Storm, where I learned I had another lovely physical disability. I didn't know this, but apparently my feet point together. They're pronate. My knees point in different directions. My legs are completely crooked. I never played sports as a kid, so I didn't know about these physical ailments until suddenly I started getting these shooting back pains, and finally my right knee just gave out. I went to the doctor, and he said, "Oh, my God, what kind of orthotics do you wear?" I said, "I don't wear orthotics." He said, "Well, you've ruined your back and your knees." So to this day, I have to wear orthotics. And I think because I broke my leg, I just discovered last year, because I broke my leg and never learned how to walk properly, I think I misused my muscles. So that my military experience was getting up, running around a track every morning, and then throwing up. That was me being a soldier.
I do want to get back to our callers. Just a couple of more questions to you about even those early days learning to read. Did it help having those tapes that your mom had made for you?
Yes.
That helped sort of deconstruct the language on the page?
And to this day, that's how I do it.
Whenever, is that right?
Whenever I do research, I try to find the audiobook version, and I listen to it with the hardcover, with the actual book in hand and a highlighter. So anytime I get to something important, I highlight it. So by the time I've finished the audiobook, I have a full book of highlights and dog ears and notes that I can go back and reference. And that's really critical for me studying.
Does it affect, do you think, the way that you write at all, the fact that you have dyslexia?
Oh, yeah, I think so. I mean, it definitely makes me more conscious of details. I hire a fact checker every time I do every book because I don't trust myself. And there's always inevitably facts that slip through. And because nothing ever came easy for me when it comes to academics, I just assume that everything I do is going to involve a lot of hard work. So I'm no stranger to just sitting down and getting it done.
And were you that kind of a student as well?
I had to be. I mean, I literally had to. I had to study for 3-4 hours a night, being tutored. Sometimes I had tutoring in my regular subjects, and if I had something like a language, I had to have additional tutoring. Yeah. And then if I was lucky, I could pull off a C grade. I was happy just to pass. So that for me was life. There was no breezing through.
And for your parents, that was as long as you were working hard and trying and getting us, that was okay?
Yeah, no, my mom said, you know, look, you have talents that school doesn't care about, and that's fine. You just have to get through the system. She said, you don't have to be an A student. You just have to do your best, and you have to pass, so then you can eventually get to a point where you can shine.
And where was that point, do you think, for you?
Oh, God, maybe in my mid-30s when my book started to get published.
Really?
Because even then I got out of graduate school and nobody was buying my screenplays. I was struggling to make ends meet. And then I got the job on Saturday Night Live, but I only did 2 seasons and then I was fired. And rightfully so. I would have fired me. I'm not a collaborator. I'm not a writer's room guy. So it was failure, 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 and then suddenly I'm a published author.
Wow. Let me get Rob from Westgrove to join our conversation. Hi, Rob. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, how
are
you doing?
Good, how are you?
I'm well, thanks. I just wanted to call and say, you know, thanks to Max. I read that book, and then I picked up World War Z. I really loved them. My whole family is into the whole zombie thing. But it was like you said, it's more educational than it is kind of about the zombies. It's more of a build-up of how to survive. And I was an Eagle Scout, so a lot of the stuff that's in that book is stuff that was in my handbook as a kid. So that was great. I just wanted to say thanks, and you know, keep on doing what you do, buddy.
Thank you. Thank you. It's actually most of my stuff comes from either my earthquake preparedness or my ROTC manual.
Oh, there you go.
I remember we did a field training at Camp Pendleton where they kept telling us, hydrate, hydrate, hydrate. And I thought, you know, Army, what do they know? And sure enough, the biggest, toughest guy in my unit had to be carried out on a stretcher because of dehydration. I never forgot that.
Rob, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You can call as well. And again, our guest is Max Brooks, and we are talking about zombies. We're talking about World War One and the Harlem Hellfighters, and talking a bit about his parents, Anne Bancroft and Mel Brooks. 1-888-477-9499. You wrote a really beautiful piece about, I guess it was after your mom died. Mm-hmm. And your dad sounds like he just kind of fell apart. And they had been married, I don't know how many years, but a long, long time they had been together.
Yeah, and you know, my father had never been alone. My father grew up in a tenement in Brooklyn in the Depression, slept in the same bed with his three brothers, and then he went from that to the army, to his first marriage, to having a roommate, to his second marriage. He never had been alone. So we sort of had to circle the wagons, and I was a brand new dad. My little boy was just born. So it was me, my wife, my son, and my dad. We kind of all hunkered down right. to sort of this little micro family, and that was a really important time for us.
Well, you said, you know, one of the things that you tried to do was to get him to go back to work, and I'm just going to quote you here. I'd always been jealous of my father's passion and devotion to his career. My mother called it his mistress. I called it his favorite son. Of all the emotional barriers I'd overcome to help my dad, embracing my childhood arch rival was the toughest.
Yeah, because as a kid, my father was very driven, very career-minded, and I missed him. I didn't have him in my life a lot because he was busy being Mel Brooks. But I realized when my mom died, that was what was going to save his life, was being Mel Brooks. So I kept saying, you got to get back to work. Call Tom Meehan, call Susan Stroman. You've talked about doing Young Frankenstein. Do it. And I think doing Young Frankenstein and getting him back on the horse, so to speak, really saved him.
But you did think of, I mean, you were, as I said, an only child, but that your sibling rival was his career?
Yeah. No, my sibling rival was definitely his career. I mean, it was hard. We could never go out because there were always strangers coming up, and my dad was very conscious of not brushing them off. He always felt like it was kind of like running for office. But that was exactly what we needed, and that's what we still need. You know, he's 88 years old, and I keep telling him, you got to work more. You know, your brain is...
Work more.
Yeah, I said, Dad, your brain is vibrant and fresh, and you're still as sharp as you ever were. You gotta work more. So he's tweeting, he's got a website, and it turns out he wants to do a one-man show next month. So
what about what? Do you know?
I don't know. I guess about him. And I say, great, do it.
I've read that you're working on another, I don't know if it's a graphic novel or not, The Extinction Parade?
Yeah, it's a comic book series. Through it, and... officially, it's zombies versus vampires, but for me, it's about struggle, and it's about the problems of privilege. You've got vampires who are at the top of the food chain. They've never had to struggle. They've never had to feel fear. They've never had to make mistakes and learn from their mistakes. Suddenly, they have an existential crisis, zombies eating the humans, their one food source out from under them. How can they adapt? Can they adapt? You know, they are these spoiled children who have never had to really rise to the occasion. And that's very important for me being a parent now. You know, we see a whole generation now of kids who are not taught to fail. You know, where they are so coddled, where both soccer teams get trophies, we're not allowed to use harsh words. They are terrified of failing, but only through failing can we grow, can we adapt, can we strengthen ourselves. And that's the Extinction Parade.
Do you think it's also having grown up in Hollywood and seeing people living appears to be very coddled lives?
Oh, God, yeah. No.
Nannies and chauffeurs and all of that.
You know, now that I'm middle-aged, now that I'm 41, about to be 42, I see the kids who had it so good and never had to fail and have their heart broken. A lot of them don't know what to do because, as we know, adversity is going to come knocking.
Yeah.
No matter how coddled you are, at some point, bad stuff's going to happen. And if you have no training in your 20s, you will not be prepared in your 40s and 50s.
I mean, you probably didn't feel this way when you were 15, but I wonder now that you're in your early 40s looking back, whether those difficult times ended up being a good thing for you.
Oh, yeah. No, God. When I was 15, I would have given anything just for an easy ride.
Not to take typewriting lessons or something.
Yeah,
right?
I would have loved to have been those other kids who'd never studied and then came in and breezed through their tests. But I realize now that I've had to overcome enough that when new troubles come, I have a history. You know, when adversity comes knocking, I go, oh, adversary, it's good to see you again. Sit down, have a cup of tea. It's good to see you again. I know you. But, you know, I do see a lot of people my age who just implode. You know, their businesses go south or their marriages get destroyed, and they don't know how to recover because they've never had to recover.
Let me get, looks like John from Reading to join our conversation. John, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Yes. Hi there. I just had a question. I'm searching for a way to kind of get my ideas out there. And graphic novels seem to be more and more the answer. And I just had a question for him of how he goes about finding the artists for his novel.
Yeah.
Well, you know, with me, I was lucky that Avatar Comics put us together. William Christensen at Avatar Comics put us together. But the truth is now with digital comics, with the internet, the whole field has changed. There's no more publishing houses you have to jump over. If you are friends with an artist, go to a comic book convention. There's millions of them coming there hawking their work. Say, hey, I got an idea. You're a great artist. Let's go 50-50, split the profits. Let's self-publish. Let's put it online. There's no excuse not to get your stuff out there anymore.
Was Kanan White your first choice?
Far and beyond my first choice. I mean, the moment I saw his work, he had been writing a comic called Uber, a World War II comic book for Avatar, which he still is doing now. The moment I saw that, I knew he could do Harlem Hellfighters.
Oh, wow. Oh, we have a tweet from Benjamin. What's the best thing you learned from your dad?
Oh, God. When you fire a .30-06 Springfield, use a towel against your shoulder. That's what he taught me.
Because it hurts, right?
Yes, because my dad, nobody knows this, my dad was a marksman in the Army. He could hit the bullseye at 100 yards every time. So he taught me. I bought a World War II rifle because it was made by a typewriter company. The Smith Corona Company made rifles. And I said, oh, I got to have this. So when I took it to the range, my dad taught me. He said, put a towel there, cushion the recoil. He said, remember, the bullet's going to drop a little bit, so aim a little high. So,
are you a good shot?
I'm getting better. I can now hit the bullseye repeatedly at 100 yards with a .30-06.
Almost out of time here. What's the best thing you learned from your mom?
Oh, my God. From my mom. There's no substitute for a good mom. That a good mom is the key to success.
Max Brooks, has been great. A great pleasure for us. Thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. And Max Brooks, our guest, and his new book, it's a graphic novel called The Harlem Hellfighters, has just been published. He's also the author of World War Z, The Zombie Survival Guide, and The Zombie Survival Guide, Recorded Attacks. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times, and you can continue this conversation. You can download podcasts of the show. You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook. You can check out the archives and get information about how to hear us on satellite radio. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Debbie Builder, and Emily Bryant. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us.